Dennis, Tom, thank you very much for these very incisive comments about Dennis's book. I'd like to open up a question and answer discussion with each of you and with our audience. And I'd like to pose an opening question, really ask both of you to comment on this. I think it's fair to say that both of you offered a pretty damning critique of the Bush administration's foreign policy in Iraq specifically and more generally. So I'd like to have you turn your gaze to the emerging policy cum political debate that we're seeing already in the run-up to the 2008 election cycle. And I'm not looking for a candidate by candidate, but I want you to take a look at the tenor of the debates, the debate that has emerged in the two parties, and apply the statecraft test that you, Dennis, have launched against the Bush administration. Apply it to the substance of the debate that we're seeing in both sides, in both parties, and see where it meets the tests and where it falls short.
Well, it's a great question. And actually, you know, part of the problem with statecraft is it's a lot easier to judge it when you're able to see what people are actually doing. So when you ask me to take a look at the debate, I can say, well, how well is the debate being framed in terms of trying to marry objectives and means? What is the objective then? Let's look at Iraq, which is really, I think, the focal point. If you look at what's being said by the candidates on each side, the candidates on the Democratic side are basically saying we've got to end the war. Most are not saying we should precipitously withdraw. Most are talking about a redeployment, training mission, focusing on the counterterror mission. So here would be a case where they are downgrading or reducing the scope of the objective, and presumably that could be tied to means that fit that. It's a little hard to go beyond that, but I would simply say if you're going to go that route, you need to be very clear in what your objective is. If I were framing the objective for the future, looking ahead, I would say the objective should really be an objective of containment from two standpoints. Number one, that what is a conflict that is within Iraq doesn't leave Iraq, that it doesn't radiate out, that a convulsion in Iraq doesn't convulse the region. So you have to have a containment approach. Two, I would emphasize one other element of containment. One of the problems we face today is that we don't know who the Osama bin Laden is going to be from this war. What do I mean by that? I mean that in the war in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, we didn't know until later that Osama bin Laden would emerge from that. There will be someone who is akin to Osama bin Laden who emerges from this war. We will see some of those who've learned their trade, sabotage, more effective arts of terror, suicide bombing. We will see battle-hardened veterans of this war going back to their homes. And that will be a source of great instability in the region, unless you can fashion a containment strategy, which is at two different levels. One level, as I said, is prevent a sectarian conflict from radiating out, prevent those who are learning their trade from leaving, crossing borders. Now, that's a pretty daunting set of means that are required. So here, it suggests that you have to think about what kinds of forces you would still have in the area or in Iraq. The administration is talking about trying to have some kind of presence of 50,000. Is that sustainable? Depends upon where the Iraqis and who the Iraqis are going to be. And here it seems to me you're going to have a military dimension to your policy, which is one set of means. You're also going to have a diplomatic dimension to your policy. I've argued for some time, and it's akin to something that Tom was saying. Today, we keep Iraq safe enough for everybody to avoid choice. If you're a sectarian leader in Iraq, the U.S. keeps the lid on. Maybe it's uncomfortable, but it's not so uncomfortable that you have to change your behavior and make excruciating compromise. If you're all the neighbors, the U.S. keeps the lid on. So we prevent the convulsion. So you really don't have to change course. I don't believe you can get the neighbors to agree to what you want in Iraq, But I think you can get the neighbors to focus on what they might fear about Iraq, which is another way of exercising leverage. So the question I guess I'm, or the answer I guess I'm giving is, on the Democratic side, at least I see a move to redefine the objectives. I don't see it on the Republican side right now. Maybe it's because of the timing, but no one wants to look like they're walking away from where the president is. But the fact is, at some point, Republican candidates are going to have to define what the objective is. What do they mean by success? For me, success at this point is to avoid the worst possible outcome. We no longer can achieve the best outcome. So how do we avoid the worst possible? I think you have to move towards what I call a containment strategy that has a military dimension and it has a diplomatic dimension, where you focus on how you get the neighbors to address what is the one thing they have in common, that nobody has an interest in Iraq falling apart, nobody has an interest in complete convulsion there. So at this stage, I would say I want to introduce statecraft into the debate.
Yeah, I would really agree with everything Dennis said. Dennis just described what I would call the Las Vegas strategy for Iraq. What happens in Baghdad stays in Baghdad. And and I think that's about the best we can hope for now. It does seem to me from my time in Lebanon that when people, as I look at the situation in Iraq, it does seem to me that there is a critical mass in the dynamic element of the Shia community, a critical mass in the dynamic element of the Sunni community, who are certain, and I suppose in the Kurdish one as well, that if we weren't there, they would be able to act in a way that would expand and benefit their position. That they're sure that if we weren't there, they could enlarge their stake or their hold. And I think as long as that's the case, I don't see any kind of real lasting and self-sustaining political resolution there. And the term really is self-sustaining. Even if the surge works, that we somehow get the level of violence down from here to here, the real test is, have you created a reality there that is self-sustaining when you leave? And I don't think you will, as long as the key players think that if only we were out of the way, they would be able to improve their position. And as tragic as it is, and it's tragic, it's horrific, I'm afraid we're going to have to let that play out. It had to play out in Lebanon until you got Taif. It had to play out in Bosnia until you got Dayton. And I would argue it's going to have to play out in Iraq. And the kind of diplomacy that Dennis charts in statecraft is necessary, but it'll only be possible, I would suggest, after the situation on the ground plays itself out. Seems to me the Democrats are doing much more thinking about this than Republicans, who are still talking about winning. And that's just not on the menu anymore. And therefore, I think a lot of their thinking has been frozen. I think that's there's a real danger in that.
Thanks. I'm going to turn the floor over to your questions. If you could please ask your question into the mic that's on the table in front of you, and if you could identify yourselves as you do that, that would be very helpful. Yes, we'll start right over here.
Hi there. My name is Josh Blumenfeld. I work for Senator Dodd. I'm sorry I can't see the speakers right back here. My question stems about this notion of credibility. Arguably, credibility is a key component of leverage. I'm curious if you could talk about the credibility that various regimes in the region have with their own people, and to what extent any kind of agreement that you could get on the Arab-Israeli peace process, Syria, Lebanon, or Iraq will suffer from the credibility gap between the regimes and their people, and how lasting will they be, if we can achieve them at all?
Okay, we're going to take a handful of questions to start out. Yes, go.
Elise Labbitt with CNN. Congratulations on your book, Dennis. Speaking as one who's traveling in the back of the plane now, I see a lot of confusing things going on, so the question might be a little confusing. I think there are two, that in the use of statecraft at the State Department, we kind of see two things. On one hand, you have all this diplomacy going on with the Middle East and trying to advance certain objectives. On the other hand, Secretary Rice is doing this thing called transformational diplomacy and trying to remake a new world order. And I was wondering if both of you could speak on the fact that, is this kind of a misuse of resources right now, trying to remake the world as a, you know, very utopian democratic place when there are so many pressing issues. Right now, the State Department Foreign Service Association just came out with a report that said perhaps we don't have enough resources to do everything we need to do right now and also try and remake the world in this transformational diplomacy. Thanks.
Thank you. Maury, we're going to work our way around. Everybody, go ahead. Into the mic, please.
Because of the stretch. I was struck by the allusion by Tom Friedman about the deal with Libya and how it could be applied here. I think what both speakers left out is that what we're facing in Iran is not only the threat of nukes, but the threat of their ideology, which is basically convert or die. And without this ideological content, unless you appreciate it, I don't think we can really understand the real threat. So it goes beyond traditional statecraft. How do you deal with people whose religious beliefs negate any kind of rational negotiation?
Yeah, Afif Safi, Palestinian representative. I'll be buying the book and unsurprisingly reading it, hoping to find an answer to a question I found intriguing for years and years, which I call the self-inflicted impotence of American diplomacy in dealing with Israel-Palestine. I believe there was a possibility for using leverage. Using that leverage vis-a-vis Israel could have improved America's lovability, respectability, credibility in main parts of the world, and yet that type of leverage was never used. American diplomacy sometimes looks as though it is Liechtenstein or Luxembourg in dealing with Israel. Dennis, I hope you offer an answer in the book.
Okay, why don't we start with these four questions, and then we'll go to a second round after that. Dennis, you want to begin, please?
Sure. Let me take them in order. First question was on credibility of the regimes in the region and, in effect, sort of the absence of their legitimacy or credibility. Can they deliver on anything they would do? What's the effect over time? My short answer would be it obviously depends upon the regime. If you're asking, could the Syrians do a deal with Israel and deliver on it, my answer is yes. The issue is not whether they could deliver on it. The issue is whether they're interested in doing it, and that's something that you'd have to test. We can, if one wants to discuss that one further, I'm willing to, but I'll stop at that one because I actually want to deal with Elisa's question in a little bit more detail. Because in a sense, you ask two issues that sort of, you raise two issues that highlight the gap between objectives and means, and what I would say are pretty indicative of still having a faith-based set of assessments, not a reality-based set of assessments. One of the things the secretary wanted to do, and I've been in favor of her greater activism, I'm going to be the last person to criticize her being active, because I think it was a mistake for us to walk away, basically, 6 years ago. But your activism has to be informed by the reality of the situation. By the way, when I say reality-based, it doesn't mean that your objectives can't be ambitious. One of the things I talk about in the book is you can have ambitious objectives, and I cite cases in the past that show you can have ambitious objectives. But again, you have to understand what reality is before you can change it. That's where a realistic assessment has to come from. Was it a reality-based assessment to go for a political horizon where you would focus on the contours of a permanent status deal when you had a divided Palestinian government and an Israeli prime minister with 2% approval rating? Was that a reality-based assessment? Well, it might have been if you were able to move the Arab states to create cover for Abu Mazen, so he wouldn't have to assume the burden of making existential compromises, because that's what's required. And you had Arab cover to create an argument for an Israeli political leader who can't make a case on his own right now and have the public accept it. He needs the context to create it. But what we found with the Arab League resolution was something important, showing that a two-state solution is still the preference, puts the Arab League on record for it. But it created an umbrella to begin a negotiation, not to conclude a negotiation. So focusing on a political horizon defined that way was not rooted in the reality. You could still pursue a political horizon, but it had to be connected somehow to day-to-day realities. Otherwise, it was going to be seen as an abstraction. And what we don't need is one more objective that looks very grand, where we have no means to pursue it, where the objective itself becomes discredited. And in fact, having a political horizon is not a bad objective, as long as you know how to define it in the correct way. Same thing applies to your point on transformation. We have an administration that frequently has very desirable but highly ambitious objectives. Democratic transformation in the Middle East is highly desirable, highly ambitious, and completely disconnected from what we're doing. We, for too long, focused on elections as being the sum total of democracy, and so we produced Hamas. So we helped strengthen, through that means, Hezbollah. So we empowered Shiite militias in Iraq. It is, I don't want to see a discrediting of certain kinds of objectives, because one of the things that does is it throws the baby out with the bathwater. It's not in our interest to see the idea of democracy lose its potency or credibility when applied to the Middle East. But it means you're going to have to come up with a different kind of a strategy, recognize, again, what your resources are. Who are your natural partners in the region? How can you actually help empower them, not weaken them? When, and I have a chapter on this in the book, when you talk to reformers in the Middle East right now, what is one of the things you have to contend with? I have very liberal reformers who actually believe in democracy who say, don't use the word democracy. Go ahead and use the word good governance, fighting corruption, rule of law, women's rights, minority rights. Use those words, but don't use the word democracy because it's discrediting us. Well, all right. One of the things we have to do, again, is connect means with objectives. With regard to the issue on Iran's ideology, what do you do in terms of this? Again, take a closer look at what's going on in Iran. Yes, the Revolutionary Guard embody the worst of the ideology. They are the keepers of the Khomeini flame. They believe in confrontation. The rest of the regime, embodied by the mullahs, are more interested in preserving their power and their place. One thing they know is that they're disconnected from the public. One of the reasons that you have such a high percentage of their income devoted to subsidies is to preserve social peace so they can preserve themselves in power. Tom had a piece on this, and I actually also discussed some of this in the book. Excuse me. If this government in Iran felt so confident and secure, would they be arresting Iranian Americans? I mean, the fact is, one of the last people arrested works for George Soros on Open Society. You know, is this someone who is a threat to the regime? Well, apparently they think he is. So if they feel that vulnerable, if they think our talking about $75 million to affect them is such a potent thing, it tells you that there's a sense of vulnerability related to regime maintenance. That tells me we have leverage. I'm more focused on changing the behavior of the regime because I'm not that confident that even though they may feel vulnerable, I'm not so confident that we can count on being able to change the regime. Our record in terms of regime change isn't such a great one. The last question on the issue of leverage vis-a-vis Israel. You know, the fact is, we didn't fail in the year 2000 because of lack of leverage on Israel. We failed in the year 2000 because we didn't have a Palestinian leader who was prepared to make a hard choice. Now, I'm not saying it was an easy choice. Statecraft involves being prepared to apply leverage to both sides. There's no such thing as a deal, and I talk about mediation here, there's no such thing as a deal where you meet the needs of only one side. You have to meet the needs of both sides. And you focus on how you create an environment where you maximize your ability to affect the behavior of each. One of the hardest things to do as a mediator is not only to get both sides to adjust to reality, but to get both sides to give up their mythologies.
First question was about the credibility of the regimes with their people. I did a column last week from Israel talking about how Israel was looking for a fourth way. You know, land for peace hasn't worked. Occupation hasn't worked. Unilateral withdrawal doesn't seem to have worked so well. So now we're past the third way. We're now looking for the fourth way. And I don't really know what that is. I think the Arab world's looking for a fourth way also. Nasserite authoritarianism, so military regimes, hasn't worked. Arab socialism didn't work. And Bin Ladenism hasn't worked. And in some ways, the Arab world did take a flyer with Bin Laden, if for no other reason than to stick a thumb in our eye and their own regimes after 2001. So I think the really interesting question right now, for me, what I'm thinking about is, will we find an Arab fourth way? And by that I mean, I mean, I ask myself this, you know, if who am I now? Am I a Bashar Assad guy? I mean, if Iraq didn't work, if the Democracy Project didn't work, what does the Institute stand for? You know, what are you guys? Are we all Hosni Mubarak men now? Do we go back to that? Are we Hamas people? You know, can there be an Arab progressivism that believes in rule of law, consensual politics, pluralism, and multi-party elections as a transition? Not the overnight thing we tried to do in Iraq, but as a transition. Is the best we can hope for the kind of decent modernizing monarchies of the Gulf, the Dubais, the Qatars, the UAEs? Or can there be a kind of fourth way, whether it's Islamist space or a more secular version, that is not democracy overnight, but that is heading in a positive, with a positive slope in some direction, so we're not left with this choice of either the Mubarak regime or the Muslim Brotherhood? Is there an Arab fourth way, let alone bin Laden? I don't know, but I think that's the question I'm asking myself. Remaking the world. I didn't know Condi was remaking the world, but if that's what she's doing, she's trying to remake the world. Yeah, that's a noble thing. I mean, it's a noble thing in my view. I'm an idealist. I'm not a realist. I'm not a cynical person. But all I know is one thing Iraq should have taught us that I certainly learned from watching Dennis collect the raw material for statecraft from the back of the plane. Here's what I learned. I learned that I think history will have a really warm place for George Bush Sr., Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, Edward Shevardnadze, Mikhail Gorbachev, François Mitterrand, for the way they took a Soviet Union that was tilted like that. And I believe in the tilt theory of history. Soviet Union was tilted like that, and they tilted it like that. And they did it without a single shot, basically, virtually a single shot being fired. Because this slope is really important, because beneath this slope is where the real transformation happens. And real transformation happens not by any American Secretary of State, happens by something that takes 9 months and 21 years. It's called a generation. Say what you want about Putin's Russia. It's not my idea of democracy, but I'll tell you one thing, anyone who's been there, there's a generation of Russians that are growing up in a context that doesn't look anything like the old Soviet Union. They have choices, they have opportunities, they have connectivity that no Russian generation has had. In my view, boy, history will have a very warm spot for the people who collectively took that big place and tilted it like that to that. That was all I ever hoped for from Iraq. I had no illusion. If you could just take it like that and tilt it like that so a generation could grow up in a different context than the Arab Muslim. People always ask me, how will you know when we've won in Iraq? I had a very simple answer. When Salman Rushdie can give a lecture in Baghdad. Okay. That was my idea of victory. So, but if we, again, go back, read Dennis's book about that period. About, he's got a great chapter on German unification. The level of collaboration, of working with allies, keeping people focused. I think, Dan, you talked about George Bush called somebody 61 times. Who was that? I mean,
he was in the First Gulf Coalition. He was the president of Turkey, Özal.
Yeah, I mean, George Bush Sr. called Turkey Özal 61 times. In other words, if you want to tilt the world, that's like a big thing. Do you know how many allies you need for that? And right now in Iraq, we're so alone. We're so alone. The Arab regimes are working again. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they're with us. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, they're against us. Sunday, they don't know what they're doing. So the Europeans are sitting on the fence. They're watching as if, you know, there's a real dangerous disease. Bush hatred makes people crazy. So here you have Putin going nuts about a radar system in Czechoslovakia, and he's funding a nuclear reactor in Iran. Okay? I mean, something's really off there. You know, Iran is building a nuclear system to his south, and he's obsessed about the Czech Air Force. You know. And that's Bush disease. He's made people so crazy, I think, particularly the Europeans, that I don't think they see their interests. So ally. You want to remake the world? Don't try to do it alone. That's kind of a lesson I take from Danny's book. To Maury's point, yeah, Iran's an ideological regime. How about Mao's China? It was a pretty ideological regime. In fact, they killed about 10 million of their own people in the Cultural Revolution. We found a way to sit down and talk to them. We found a way to manipulate their interests and ours in a way that created a happy medium that changed the world. Is Iran's, are the mullahs in Iran any less ideological than Mao's China? He put his whole country into the countryside on a cultural revolution. So I think Denny's got it right. I think there are three basic parties in Iran. I call them Iran-E, Iran-C, and Iran-R. Iran evil, really bad guys in the Revolutionary Guards. And I think there are some really bad people there who mean only bad things. Iran-C, the Iran conservatives, the mullahs, basically who are the foundation of the regime, who just want to make sure they stay there. And then Iran-R. That's a country with real politics. That's the great thing about Iran. And what seems to me is we've never activated that politics to get it working for us. And by this policy of basically what I would call the Cuba policy toward Iran has worked as well as it's worked with Cuba. I believe Castro's on his 11th president. And I see no reason why Iran will be any different, particularly Iran is Cuba with oil. And unless you find a way to change the dynamic where you move Iran C away from Iran E toward Iran R, I think that's the ballgame. I think it's possible. It may be late now, but I wouldn't say that that place is beyond politics at all. In fact, I think what I'm always struck by when I go to Iran is how much real politics still exists there. Israel-Palestine, you know, I think, you know, Danny said it, which is that I'm a big believer there's only one leverage that counts. If you're talking about West Bank and Gaza, it's where the Israeli people are. And who has the Israeli people on his side of the table or her side of the table? Anwar Sadat went to Jerusalem. He got the Israeli people on his side of the table. Begin had to go along with the Israeli people, seems to me. King Hussein came to Israel. He got the Israeli people on his side of the table. He got what he wanted. The thing that I've never understood about Camp David, and the reason it had a big effect on me, the Camp David that Dennis was involved in and wrote about, is that I've never quite understood this one point. That I don't know what Barack offered Arafat there. Was it 96%, 95, 91, 92, 85? I don't know. All I know is it wasn't 40%, and that's what was on the table before. Now, if I had been struggling for 100 years for an independent state, and suddenly my interlocutor moved from 40% to 90%, what should have been the right answer from Arafat? In my view, there was only one right answer. No. No, thank you. I'm sorry. We are entitled to 100%. You've occupied our land. We're not going to take anything less than Jordan got or Egypt got. My answer is no, Mr. Barack. No, but. But now I want to work with you to bring the Israeli people around to get you from 90 to 100. Because I think if I actually work with you on that, I can get them from 90 to 100. I find the whole debate really pretty stupid, frankly, on whether it was really 92, but it was 94. That's not the issue. To me, the question for history is why the answer wasn't no but rather an intifada. And to me, all the leverage would have been on Palestinian side had Yasser Arafat just said no, no but.
Thank you. I can assure you that Bashar al-Assad is not the poster child yet of the Institute. And on that theme, I'm going to turn to Ted Kutuf for our next question, former ambassador to Syria.
Thank you, Rob. Ted Kutuf, president of Amid East. Tom Friedman made the point that while we were preoccupied with WMD that did not exist in Iraq, North Korea took advantage of the situation to acquire pretty hefty nuclear capability, and Iran is well on its way. And what I'm wondering is, at the moment, at a time when we seem to be somewhat obsessed on Iran and the possibility that it might get the capability, at least, of making nuclear weapons, that Pakistan could be going at some point down the tubes, and we could be faced with an Islamist or a very right-wing regime that would scare the hell out of India and the neighborhood and lead to consequences much worse than what we're worrying about now. And Dennis, that, you know, Pakistan got nuclear weapons on your watch on the during the 90s. So if you and Tom would like to comment on that.
Alan Gerson up in front.
Dennis made the argument that a healthy foreign policy is one which is reality-based and one which is faith-based, is a society that is malfunctioning and ill. So my question is, could you tell us a little bit more about the disease, if you would, of faith-based assessments? Is this something that is endemic to neocons or this particular administration? Will it change if there's a change in regime? And what have you learned about the causes of faith-based assessments?
And I wanted to close by asking if you, Tom, could go back into your questioner mode and pose a question to Dennis, based on the themes of his book and what has come out in today's discussion, after we conclude with these questions. Okay.
Ted, I'm not saying that had my focus been other than Arab-Israeli issues, I would have prevented Pakistan from going nuclear. But you do highlight what is a very important point. In some ways, it's kind of relevant that it's coming in this time frame. Last Monday, we actually held a forum here on the 40th anniversary of the 1967 war. And one of the things that was profoundly limiting to the Johnson administration was its complete and total preoccupation with Vietnam. It limited its capacity to pay the kind of attention to this that it should have. It certainly limited the means that were available internationally, but also domestically, because the Congress wasn't prepared to back an international flotilla. So preoccupation imposes a high price, especially if something else happens around the globe. I would say that we have been not just preoccupied with Iraq. Since 2009-11, we've been preoccupied, the administration has been preoccupied with the war on terror for understandable reasons. It shaped its approach to Pakistan exclusively through a particular lens. One notices that the only time that Musharraf really does anything significant in Waziristan is when we happen to put a spotlight on it. And then as soon as the spotlight is off, it's sort of back to business as usual. Now we see something happening in Pakistan, a real political stirring. I mean, the firing of the Chief Justice has triggered something that we haven't seen in Pakistan. I mean, it may well be the elite that has found its voice, but it's finding its voice in a way that is also attracting a lot of attention. Musharraf didn't back off on his decision on independent media because suddenly he felt particularly strong. So I think here is a case where taking a closer look at what's going on there is important. Pushing Musharraf over the cliff is the last thing we want to do, particularly given what some of the alternatives might be. But also allowing him to maintain a posture where he progressively loses more credibility, and as he does it, our credibility goes down at the same time because of our association with him, is also not where we want to be. I would like to see more of a strategic discussion quietly done with Musharraf, even though I will tell you that, and I say it in the book, I'm a very big believer that private discussions are very important, but private discussions also have to have public consequence. Private discussions that have no public consequence, especially in the part of the world where I've dealt and you've dealt, we both know anything that stays private and will remain that way puts no pressure or leverage on anybody. So it's at a certain point, Musharraf has to know that we will have a different public posture. On the issue of your question, which is extremely interesting, it's obviously a faith-based assessment can be done by anybody. It doesn't have to be a neocon. I can look at people who would be on the other side of the spectrum who would also apply faith-based views. As an example, I would say that, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think President Carter's book is a faith-based assessment, not a reality-based assessment. So the question is, how do you ensure that you produce enough diversity within an administration without producing paralysis? Tom said something very important, and I actually have it. I have a lessons chapter after I look at a number of historical cases in the book, I try to draw out of these historical cases what it tells us about how you do statecraft effectively. And the fact is, administrations that were good at statecraft weren't just good because they could develop the right concepts. They weren't just good because they knew how to orchestrate and implement and use all the instruments at their disposal. They could do the latter because they were organized in a way where even if there was debate, when the debate was concluded, they acted in a unified way. One of the things that an administration has to do is create a sociology from the top, where debate is permitted, groupthink isn't, and there's an understanding that, and the president's the one who sets the tone. The president's the one who basically has to say that, you know, we have debates, we don't have decision points. You don't get to continue to fight the fight. We'll resolve decisions. We want a healthy debate where we flesh, in a sense, everything is aired, so we think these things through. But we also then actually act. This administration, the Bush administration, in the first term did not have an Iranian policy. It had two schools of thought, regime change or engagement. Nobody ever made a decision. So the only policy that existed was the Europeans' policy. So this is something that any administration could be victim, could fall victim to. And what I would suggest is one important lesson for the next administration, and it really starts with the president, and it reflects how the president makes appointments and how he insists on having a certain kind of sociology within the administration. You know, I look at both President Bush 41 and also President Clinton, two very different presidents, two very different approaches in terms of structure and organization. But the fact is, each of them, in a certain way, were able to create their own means for ensuring that policies were unified. In Clinton's case, what he ended up doing it by creating a series of special envoys who had a kind of capacity to bring all the bureaucracy together under him. In Bush's case, it was without special envoys, but it was done from the top, where people were appointed, and they understood the president wanted there to be a thorough discussion, but then everybody had to work together. And I can tell you, being just just below the top level, Secretary Baker used to say to us, you know, you leak anything against anybody else, and you're out of here. This was something that was part of the sociology of the administration. You carried out your discussions, you did your debates, but then you worked together. And you're going to have effective statecraft, you have to have organization that reflects that and a sociology infused by it.
I'll just make a couple of points real quickly to Ted's. I wasn't part of the Pakistan, obviously, you know, decision making. I was an observer. But this may be one of the very few things Dennis and I disagree on. But I think NATO expansion was a disaster. I think it's the gift that keeps on giving. I've always believed that there is no problem in the world we can be effective on without the help of Russia. In the long term, I think we've paid an enormous price, a needless price, for NATO expansion. And it really, to me, the rubber meets the road on these really hard questions of Pakistan, Iran, the really hard states where a slightly different Russian policy could make a huge difference. And don't think that, you know, we don't talk about it here much. We did NATO expansion. It was great. We had it. Everybody, you know, we got the Czech Air Force into NATO, and everybody's all happy. But ask yourself this, the real question, Michael Mandelbaum points this out, and I think he's got it exactly right. It's not, why does Putin say these things? Suddenly it's outbursts. Ask yourself this, why are they so popular in Russia? That's the real question. Why is his thumb in your eye of the United States so popular at home? That's what should trouble us. And that goes back, in my view, to NATO expansion. On faith-based assessment, you know, I don't know anything particular about that, but I think Dennis has got it exactly right in the book. That's, I think, what we saw a lot of in many cases. I just know as a reporter, if you don't go, you don't know. That's my motto as a reporter, that by going somewhere, you kind of reduce the odds that you'll get it wrong. And I just think of how much I learned from all my travels, and I think of a president who, it's a cliche, but who just really is not well-traveled. And I think the place where it really came to a head from my point of view was whenever Bush used to say, the generals have not asked me for more troops. Generals have not asked me. The question I always had is, what did you ask them? You're reading the papers. Everything you wanted, hoped for, it's going up in flames. It's not what did they ask you.
What did you ask them?
And I think someone who doesn't have the most elemental curiosity to stop and ask them is really subject to this phenomena that Dennis wrote about. And that leads to my closing question for Dennis. We've had a lot of talk, Denny, about experience. Does Obama have as much experience as Hillary? Did Hillary have as much as Rummy? Was Rummy's experience even relevant? But Bush didn't have experience, and he got it, you know. And my question for you, Dennis, because you're going to be asked this, and I think your book is a primer for someone without experience. But I think the really relevant question is, experience for what? Because what is going to be new about the world, the next candidate, him or her, is going to inherit? That what is the real experience you're going to need? We certainly know being chief of staff to Gerald Ford was not the appropriate experience. We've had an ample lab test of that. But going forward, you've written this book. It's full of really valuable lessons. But I think underlying your book, Dennis, is a sense that there are some constants, but there are going to be some things that are new. And maybe, I'm not here to endorse anybody, but maybe Barack Obama actually has the perfect experience for this kind of world. Maybe Hillary Clinton does. Maybe, you know, Thompson does. I don't know. But experience for what? I'm writing a column about this next week. I don't want anyone stealing this.
You know, I do have one chapter in the book that talks about the new international landscape. And it deals with, in effect, what's consistent with what we've seen before and what's new and what we have to contend with now. And rather than tell you about that, you get to read about it. And then we'll have a quiz. I think the real issue here is recognizing the following, that the world we're going to contend with now is a world that almost by definition, we do need partners for everything we do, not in the sense that we have to let them define what's important, but we do have to have partners because on our own, with our own means, it's not going to be sufficient. And in effect, especially in the aftermath of Iraq, where you're going to have to convince the American public as well. One of the things that's going to weigh on the next administration is they're going to inherit a legacy. And it's a legacy where we're stretched to the bone when it comes to the military. We have a number of policies that, as a new president, you get to inherit, like Iraq. You're going to inherit Iraq, and it's not going to be fixed, and that's going to weigh on you. In all likelihood, you're going to inherit a situation in the Middle East that is even worse than it is today. So some of what you're going to have to deal with is recognizing how bad things are, and asking the people around you who you bring in to focus on taking a very hard look. Number one, what are the most important priorities you as president are going to have to contend with? Some of these are going to be imposed on you because you're inheriting them. But some of them should also be governed by, are there any areas where we have potential opportunities? And how do they relate to some of the more onerous challenges that we face? The task at this point, I think, to deal with your basic question is getting a group of people around who will thrash out what is the array of challenges that we face, what are the means that we have at our disposal or with others, who might not be working with us today, who has the means to be much more effective in terms of dealing with what might be the most important priorities. Let's take Iraq just as an example. I said it a little bit earlier. In the end, all of Iraq's neighbors, for their own reasons, are going to want to have an interest in a containment policy, not as a favor to us. No one is going to want to pull our chestnuts out of the fire. One of the problems I had with the Secretary of State in advance of the Sharm el-Sheikh conference, more than once saying she really hoped the Iranian foreign minister would come, was she sent a message. We need you more than you need us. They were already saying we're going to be there. They just were equivocating on the level. Why did it matter to us on the level? Ahmadinejad has already said, we've asked them, we've approached them 41 times. Again, in the context of Iraq, what's the message? The message is, we need you more than you need us. So let's Let's say that's going to be the most immediate priority, although I suspect that Iran may weigh very heavily as well. And here again, you're going to have to think, all right, how is it what you want to do in Iraq, how is it going to affect what you want to do on Iran? So you're going to have people who can look not at issues in isolation from each other, but how they fit together. You're going to have to look at who in the array of countries and leaders out there might be prepared to change their behavior in a way that is helpful to you. And in a sense, what this calls for is less the word experience and more the word judgment. In a new president, what you're looking for is someone who can fit priorities, who understands the real situation, who, by the way, isn't going to be content. I said it before. We don't have to accept a situation that's bad and say we can't be ambitious. But our ambition has to be informed by the reality as it is so that we develop a strategy for how to change it. Judgment is where it's going to start, establish clear priorities, see the world as it is, have people there who look across the array of choices that we might have and who can actually assist with the leverage and what we might have to do to get them to do things they haven't been prepared to do up till now. One thing a new administration may have going for them is that they're simply not called Bush. And that gives others more of an ability to explain why they might be changing course. That's unfair to the administration. You know, what they're accused of oftentimes greatly exceeds a lot of their responsibilities. Not always, but frequently. And the point, I think, here is that when others have an explanation to change course, they may well do it, but we also have to think about what is it we can do to make it easier for them to change course? How do we help give them an explanation? One of the things that was most important, if you look at what Baker did in putting together and sustaining the coalition in 1991, and you contrast it to what was done in 2002, 2003, Baker went places and he gave people a public platform to explain what they were doing to show how we were soliciting them. When we show that we're soliciting others, it's a whole lot easier for them to be responsive to us. And by the way, it doesn't look like they're doing our bidding. It looks like they're deciding on the basis of their own interests. If you want to have real leverage, think about how you shape explanations for others where they're able to basically say why they're doing it in their own terms. That would be judgment.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, statecraft, right next door, borders, special discount for all of you. Please join me in thanking Tom Friedman for joining us today and in congratulating Dennis on his outstanding achievement.